Do you remember playing as a child? What was your favourite game or thing to play with? Who taught you how to play? Did it involve your imagination? What would happen if you gave the kids in your life right now a cardboard box, some old fabric, and an afternoon? Would they make a castle, a pirate ship, or a chair to watch TV in? You might find this hard to believe, but some children don't actually know how to play, and parents don't know how to teach them. Why? Professor Karen Stagniti is an occupational therapist and teaches at Deakin University and will be running some workshops on play with Bush Kids. Hello, Professor.
Hi, how are you, Kat?
Very well, thank you. Somewhat exhausted, for I have a 2.5-year-old who would be building a fort if I gave her any and all of those things I mentioned in my introduction there.
She sounds great.
She's pretty awesome.
Yeah, but she sounds good.
Let's talk about playing. Do children really not know how to play?
Well, in my world, I work with children with some developmental issues, and a few years ago I was doing some research really looking at how to measure play and what to look for, and I realised that a lot of the children I was working with were 2 to 4 years behind in their ability to play. So, there are children who do have difficulty playing, because playing looks very simple, but it's actually a very complicated skill.
Isn't it innate?
Good question. There's books and books on discussions of that. Most people think it's something natural that develops, and we all have different preferences for what we like to play and where we like to play, but there are some children who, particularly the imaginative play, because that's what I'm particularly interested in, it really needs to be taught to a child. A child really needs to be shown what to do.
Has that always been the case?
I think it has, yes.
Do you think that modern technology, there's always great debates about how much screen time a child should have and how much time they're spending not interacting with the world around them. Do you think that's having much of an impact on this?
I often think about that. I think screens are the next level of toy that have come in. So you had, right in the beginning, no toys, you made your own, and then you had trains go through, you had iron toys and then tin toys, and then plastic was discovered, so you had plastic toys and then television and then advertising. So the toys and then electronic toys, and I think screens are the next layer. The problem with the next layer of screens is that children sit and are passive with them. So I think it has more impact than previous toys. I'd also think that if you've got a child who's developing well and can play, you know, screens really are just another part of what they do. It's just another part of their life. For the children who I work with, often they'll go to screens because actually engaging in play with other children is just too hard. Mm. So a screen is a bit more straightforward for them.
When we talk about play and imaginative play more specifically, what does that mean? What does that look like?
Imaginative play, well, what it looks like is dress-ups, having cups of tea, pretending that you're going on a big journey, using objects and pretending there's something else. So maybe picking up, you know, the TV remote and pretending that's a mobile phone, or picking up a block and pretending to talk on the phone. It also includes children, particularly from just about 2 years and older, treating their dolls or teddies or special toys as if they're, you know, breathing and real and talking back to them. So that's all part of that imaginative play.
Do parents teach us how to play? I remember a fair bit of go outside and play,
yes,
rather than come here and I'll show you how to play.
Yep.
Do parents need to teach a child? How much input do they need to have?
I think a parent needs to provide the time for children just to play, to think, you know, for a child to think about what to do and how to engage, particularly as children are getting closer to, you know, 4 and 5 and going to preschool, So the time to play and the space to play, and also, you know, allowing props and different sorts of objects for a child to engage with. And also it's useful if you can cope with a little bit of mess.
A little bit of mess.
Yes.
All of the mess everywhere all at once. My name's Kat Davidson. This is ABC Local Radio Queensland. My guest is Professor Karen Stagniti. She's an occupational therapist who teaches at Deakin University, and she's running some workshops on play with bush kids, which we'll get to in a little while. When we're talking about children here, Karen, how old are we talking?
In terms of playing?
Yeah.
Oh, I think all children, really, all ages.
So anyone that hasn't got their license yet?
Oh, I think even people with licenses, you know, there's adult play, you know, but it changes. It looks different. So play under two looks different to play from about, you know, two to seven or eight, and then you get middle childhood play, which looks a bit different to adolescent play.
How important is it, do you think, to their development?
Well, I'm pretty biased, really. I think it's pretty essential. And every time I doubt that, I come across a child where I see their play skills, you know, becoming more complex, and it changes their language, it changes how they socially understand their world, it changes their problem solving, you know, it increases them, gives them more skill. And I think about how important it is when you see children who can't play. And you go, well, there's something not right here.
Mm.
So I think it's the type of activity where you're using your thinking skills, you're using problem solving, you're using socially reading a situation, you're often using your language or your internal language. You're using all these at the same time when you play. And I think it's a good foundational It integrates a lot of skills.
It's such a strange thing when you become a parent to relearn. I found, anyway, perhaps I'm only speaking from my own experience, but I haven't, before I had my child, who's 2.5, Rory, I hadn't spent a great deal of time crawling around on the grass.
No.
But now I spend quite a great deal of my time with a cape on, pretending I'm something crawling across the grass. It's somehow liberating, and really, it took a while to kind of get my head right.
Yes, because as adults, you know, as play changes as you grow, and so by the time you're you know over 18 and driving, and your play is totally different. It's more like going out to a cafe or going to sports or going to the beach or whatever you enjoy doing. It's often called leisure. So going back to those really early stages of play is a big mind shift. Yeah, I agree with that.
What do you do if you're someone, if you are a carer, if it's not the primary care, if you're someone that spends quite a lot of time with a child and it doesn't come naturally to you, either physically you're not able to get down on the ground and crawl around, or you're someone who isn't naturally drawn to storytelling or make-believe, how can you then impart or help impart those sorts of skills?
That's a good question. And I have a parent learn to play program that I'm also training people when I'm with bush kids. It's about, part of it for me is being beside parents and working beside parents and actually showing them or helping them understand what play looks like in their child and what they could do to extend it. And also I work with a lot of parents who find it really quite hard to play. So it's really working with people with what they're comfortable with. So if they can allow their child some space and some time, and maybe even providing just, you know, some different props or some different toys, or putting different toys out some weeks to other weeks. And often it's just sitting with a child and moving a toy, and a child will usually respond. And then looking at how the child's responding to that, and then having fun. And I think when parents can look at their child and understand the play and enjoy that, they see their child in a different way. often with the parents who talk to me about it. And I'm hoping that part of that is a joy in just enjoying their child. So you talked about, you know, crawling around and wearing capes. You know, it should be fun. It should be enjoyable.
It is till you get crash tackled. You got to watch. They're very quick.
Well, that rough and tumble play is really important for boys in particular.
Right.
Because they learn how to emotionally gauge themselves. And I also remember the same, you know, we'd be jumping all over my father and racing around the yard and all that sort of really active rough and tumble sort of activity and play.
All the stuff that makes the mother close her eyes. Please don't throw her in the air that high.
Yes, that's right.
Please stop. What do you do in the instance if you have a child who is quite a stickler for the details? If you have a child who, for whatever reason, whether it be something developmental or just their kind of personality, that they're it's difficult for them to engage in something that is make believe. They, you know, the giraffe doesn't talk. Or
yes.
How do you deal with that?
The children that are really literal.
Yes.
Yeah, that's my job. That's what I do a lot of. So what I do first is I understand where they are, where their play is, and that gives me a really good idea of where to start and where to engage with that child. And I'll often talk to the parents about if there's something particularly that's interesting to that child. So, for example, cars or trains, I might start with that. And what I do is I show, often children who are like that actually don't know how to use the toys. So in the early stages, it'll be actually showing the child how to use the toy, because I've seen a lot of boys that didn't know how to use a truck. So what they knew about a truck is if you pushed it really hard against the wall, it'd bounce back. But not understanding you can actually make a truck drive and stop and park, you can put things in the back of it and you can take things from one end of the room to the other. And then you can start to build a little tiny story. So I usually start where the child is, and then I usually show them the things they can do with the toys, and it's really playing beside them. And looking, I usually am really enjoying it. And children will often enjoy you because it looks interesting. And then as they start to imitate and copy, slowly children understand, or sometimes more quickly, what it is to use those objects and what it is to engage in a play activity or pretend to, you know, have cups of tea and where it's too hot or you spill it or you give a cup of tea to the teddy. So within a little play story, I'll start to add little extra things to it. So children get a better idea of what's actually happening in that play scene. And I work on with the pace of the child. And if a child is a stickler and needs to finish, you know, a sequence or a particular thing, I'll just wait for them to do that and then bring them back to the play or an aspect of the play that we're working with.
How important is it that they get to use these skills with other children, not just the adults in their lives?
I really think that that's important. For some children, I'll start working with them one-on-one with their parent to actually get them understanding what play looks like and what play feels like and what it is. And then I'll find that after, with the Learn to Play therapy session, about 7 or 8 sessions in, the children are starting to understand what their peers are doing. They're starting to see what that means, and their social turn-taking starts to become obvious to other people who know the child. And that whole area of that social interaction is a whole other level of complexity. But it usually starts with, you know, taking turns or seeing. There was a story years ago when in a daycare centre, one of the children we were working with, they'd put up a shop. And the child joined the queue in the shop, and it's a food shop. And when he got to the counter to order, he actually ordered something to eat. And so he'd understood that this was happening. This was the play scene about shopping and getting in the queue, and then you say what you want and you pretend to hand over money and you take something. So on that level, that child wasn't doing a lot of one-to-one interaction, but he was part of a group. And that, surely that makes children feel like they belong.
What are some of the things that can limit a child's ability to play?
Physical movement. Can limit the physical engagement in play. The other things that can limit a child's ability can be a severe environmental impact. A trauma can often interrupt a child's development, or you can have your play interrupt or your development interrupted, which impacts on your play through a particular diagnosis. So children with autism, for example, often are interested in how things work, but not so interested in a story about a teddy bear going for a trip, for example. So all these different things can impact on how a child can play and how they engage.
What is the outcome for a child who doesn't develop the ability to play?
This is me over years just observing, and also a bit of reading as well. If you're looking at play in terms of that ability to create a story and to think about what you're going to play and to use lots of objects and to have your friends playing with you, you understand, or children don't know this, but they're building up this ability to understand how people interact within certain play scenes, how children interact with certain roles. So when you're an astronaut, you say things and you do things that are quite different to if you're playing hairdressers, for example. So they get to understand that people's behaviour and what they say changes in different situations. Children usually become a little bit more flexible, become better at negotiating. And understanding a story, they can think forward. They can think about what's going to happen next. And children who don't develop those set of skills are more likely to be a bit more literal in how they understand the world and a little bit more rigid and don't like change, really. They like to have things very predictable and know where things are going. So, but it can be very different for different people.
My name's Kat Davidson. This is ABC Local Radio Queensland. Professor Karen Stagniti is an occupational therapist and teaches at Deakin University. We've spoken about bush kids on evenings before and the allied services they provide to families in regional Queensland who don't have services like speech pathology, psychologists, family health support workers and occupational therapists on their doorstep. Karen, you're going to be doing some work with bush kids on play. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I'm going to do a couple of things. So in Mount Isa, I'm going to take people through a two-day workshop, looking at the development of imaginative play or pretend play, and then looking at why those skills that you learn through play are important for a child's language, narrative, social skills. And then looking at how you understand play when you're looking at it, how you assess it, what you look for and what that means. And then we're also going to look at how then when you understand where a child's playing, how you build that skill, how you work with a child to engage that child and make play interesting and to develop their skills. And then in Bundaberg, the workshop's really targeted at particularly children who have a diagnosis of autism. So how that impacts on their play, what their play may look like, and then how you engage a child. Some of the comments before, you know, how you engage a child that really just wants to do what they want to do. How do you engage them and broaden their skills out a little bit more?
Who attends these programs?
Usually there's a range of people. So we have therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists, psychologists, early childhood intervention workers. Sometimes I also get teachers who are in the region, particularly teachers who work at special schools or teachers who might be working in the early years of school. Occasionally I might get a parent, but I have a different workshop for parents. But the program with Bush Kids is more geared at giving skills and building capacity in the professional staff.
You've delivered these workshops before. What sorts of questions do you get? What sorts of things do you think that people working with children are struggling to be able to bring them these skills?
It's really the ability to play, as you say. You know, when you're an adult, you forget. So it's I do a lot of practical work around playing the skills, being able to look at, and a lot of videos of what you're looking at. One of the recurrent questions is about children who are really rigid, how you actually engage them in play, and how you play beside a child without actually telling the child what to do, but how you engage a child in play beside you so that they're engaging and they're emotionally engaged in the play, because we know that's a lot more effective when children are totally engaged emotionally and totally focused on the play.
The Bundaberg one has an autism focus. How different do we need to treat play with children on the autism spectrum?
Yes, that's a good question. I approach children looking at their play, and I take it in terms of how they're playing. And the diagnosis has some impact, but not as much as people think. I had a master's student look at four different groups of children who had a different diagnosis, because she was interested in whether you have, for example, autism or Down syndrome or developmental disability, whether that really was associated with a particular way to play. And what she found was that no, it didn't. It didn't have an impact. What was more important was that child's ability in terms of cognition, in terms of thinking, their language ability and their fine motor ability, their hand manipulation ability. So children on the spectrum tend to be a lot more literal. They tend to often be a little bit more rigid, but they're all so different. They're all so different. I find them really, I just love working with them. I think they're just such interesting little people. So I really look at how they're playing and for them what that looks like, and then I work from there.
Do you think it's possible that some of what you're telling these professionals, these speech pathologists, psychologists, family health support workers, all of these people who are coming to you, is that a child who doesn't appear to want to play actually does want to? Is there some feeling, do you think, that people think, you know, a child who seems rigid for whatever reason just isn't interested, and that's not the case?
Well, that's how they come across, because they don't know what you're doing. So play to children who don't know what play is and don't see it in their peers, they don't understand what their peers are doing, play is not interesting to them. And so that's why it's so important when you're starting to engage in a child. There's a whole lot of different techniques I use to engage children. But once they're engaged and once they start to understand what it looks like emotionally, I find children become so much happier. And it really struck me a couple of years ago when I saw these children who were coming in really upset to start with. And then once they understood it was safe and it was fun, they'd be, you know, clapping in the car when they saw the building and skipping into the room, and literally, and just smiling and looking so much more relaxed. So I think these children really do want to engage, and I have seen a lot of children who wanted to engage with their peers but didn't really know how to do it. And then they lose all these opportunities for social interaction. So, but once they start to understand these skills themselves and develop their own skills, they seek out children. You know, they enjoy playing with other children. But when they don't understand play and they look at children and don't understand what they're doing, then they don't know what's happening, really.
What do you hope is the effect? I mean, you're teaching these professionals who deal with children how to pass on the skills of play to the kids. For the parents and grandparents of children who struggle to play, who are listening in the regional areas, when do you think there might be a trickle-down effect for them?
In terms of professionals taking the skills?
Yeah. I mean, is it something that you can take a two-day workshop in and then be immediately a lot better at dealing with play? Or is this something that you kind of plant the seed in the professionals and they need to continue on with?
That, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. That's a very pertinent question. In terms of my training and in terms of what I offer, I think in a two-day workshop, you can give people the skills to know. I really make my workshops as practical as I can with enough depth so people know why they're doing things. But I would hope that people start to embed play in their practice. They start to look at children with different eyes, with new skills and different understanding of, oh, okay, so maybe I need to look at the play. I need to understand how this child's play skills or lack of play skills is impacting on how this child participates in their own life. And then knowing where to start and where to begin. But a lot of the engaging children in play is practice. It's a lot of practice. It's also understanding and being comfortable in uncertainty is what I talk about. So when I'm going in to work with a child and the parent building play, I know my aims, I know what I'm wanting to achieve, and I know where I'm starting. But it really depends on how that child's responding and how what happens in the session and in what I'm doing. So it's becoming comfortable with that level of uncertainty.
Is it when you're dealing with teachers, when they come in to do these sorts of workshops, is there much in the curriculum already for a high school or a primary school teacher to engage in play with a child?
We need to put a little bit more in. I do quite a bit of work in mainstream schools, and I've got a PhD student, Chloe O'Connor, at the moment, who's looking at embedding play in schools and special schools. And I do work with a couple of the early childhood education people at Deakin, Louise Passion, Andrea Nolan. So we've been, and they are teachers or were teachers. So going in and working with teachers in mainstream schools is a little bit different because you're working with teachers who have all these curriculum objectives to meet. And often we're going in where teachers are going, actually what we're doing isn't engaging the children, and we're noticing that children are coming in with low language levels or you know, they're not engaged in the learning. So it usually starts with either a principal or teachers going, actually there's more we could do here, and then it's working with teachers of how to embed play in a curriculum and what that might look like. But schools, I find it's most effective where schools work out what they need for their school and what they need for their children, and then how they're going to do that, whether it's embedded right through the day or whether it's in the morning or whether it's every morning. Or
so if you got your hands on the school curriculum, Professor Karen Stegnity, there's not one cure-all for this. There wouldn't be a unit you'd drop into the curriculum or a solution that would make sure that children had play.
Working with Louise, I think for teachers, it's not letting them think it's another thing they have to think about. It's about play. You can embed play in a classroom where you can link all the Ausvals to, or you can link all the literacy. You know, a lot of the literacy objectives you can actually embed through play. You can actually use play to do that. But it's not easy for a teacher to make the shift to what play looks like in a curriculum, in a classroom, because their role has to shift and what they're observing shifts. And so and some teachers are really comfortable with that, and some teachers are not comfortable with that. So I find it's a whole area that we really need to get a lot more training in.
And if I can selfishly move you back to what if there is a parent listening or a grandparent listening who hopefully will get, there'll be childhood professionals who will understand the importance of play, and that will trickle down to their kids. But if you're listening right now and you're thinking, I'm not sure the last time I played with my child or grandchild, what would be the top three things that, if I may put you on the spot, I'm sure you've got a list right next to you there, Karen, the top three things you should do to make sure your child, grandchild, favourite godchild knows how to play?
Well, I think play is pleasurable and fun and spontaneous. So you have put me on the spot. So what I would do first is probably start with, if you've got a puppet or a story or a truck or whatever that child likes, and just start moving it in front of the child, but do something really unusual with it. and see how the child reacts. And hopefully they see that it's fun and they're interested and they want to come and sit down with you or move with you and do and engage with you. Throwing a ball, I find, is really good for particularly the little, really active little 2 and 3 year olds. Often I work with, so throwing a ball, but I'll often have a puppet or a big doll that's catching the ball. And I know not everyone has that in their house.
Everyone's got a sock.
Everyone's got a sock, or you've got a sock that you know chases the ball and tries to get it off them. So you're bringing in, even with just the sock on your hand, pretending it's a puppet, you're bringing in that what's called decentration. You're bringing in the ability to understand something else can be real and alive. And often, if you get a puppet, I find with a lot of the kids I work with, a puppet or a doll, a child will engage in because they're non-judgmental. You know, they're something that they can talk to and you know, they don't come with all the emotions that people come with, although you can put emotions on them. But and so that's two. So and a third one would be having things like boxes and cloth and sticks or tins or leaves, and again, just building something out of it, just creating something. But you're really looking at a child who's probably 2.5 and older for that type of thing.
My house is full of dinosaurs, Karen.
Yes, dinosaurs are great, and I hope they go on adventures.
Oh, they do. They do. They're often made out of mummy's nice dresses, if I'm not quick enough. But
wow.
Yeah, yep. There's many a dinosaur getting around my place. Professor Karen Stagnetti is an occupational therapist and teaches at Deakin University. Now, if you are interested in coming along, if that's something that resonates with you, my advice would be to go to the Bush Kids website and look that up. It's bushkids.org.au. She will be, the lovely Karen will be in Mount Isa on the 7th and 8th of September for the Play Assessment and Learn to Play workshop, and in Bundaberg on the 17th of September for the Play and Autism Spectrum Disorder workshop. So if you're interested, I'd jump on that website as soon as you can and get the rest of the details. Karen, thank you so much for spending some time with us this evening.
Thank you, Kat.